Chapter 7. Martin Reardon was Laurel's maternal uncle and the only sibling her mother had. Like the rest of his immediate family and Laurel herself, he'd grown up in a small Michigan town that he'd left at the first opportunity. Laurel told herself she had to leave for a good education, but the truth was she'd wanted out too. It had been a stifling environment. Laurel was bright, curious, and talented. Most people like her did not stay, or they found a way to be those things, despite the pressures to conform. Uncle Martin had been even more determined to escape. He'd come out as gay in high school, something Laurel knew would have been difficult back then, and 3 days after his high school graduation, he'd packed up his things and moved to New York City. "That must have been terrifying," Laurel once said when he'd retold the story for the 100th time. "Not as terrifying as the possibility of staying in Michigan," he'd replied. "I would have killed myself at some point, or forced myself to live a lie. I'd pretty much ruled out the second option by being the only out gay kid in school, but closets are always there for us to go back into. I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy." "You don't have any enemies, Uncle Martin," she'd said. He had just smiled at her, as if he most certainly did have enemies, but they would remain nameless. Martin had met Frank Troy under the most horrifying circumstances. Wandering around Greenwich Village a few days after the World Trade Center attack. He hadn't known anyone who died in the Twin Towers, but the entire city grieved as one. He was looking at photographs that had been placed on a fence across from St. Vincent's Medical Center, which was still in operation then and had become a focal point for a community in crisis. He was moving sideways along the wire mesh with his eyes glued to pictures of the dead and missing when he bumped into someone doing the same thing. "Excuse me," Martin had said. "So sorry," the man replied at the same time. They turned to look at each other, and 22 years later, they were a happily married couple living in Lambertville, New Jersey. Both men had wanted to leave New York after the trauma of September 11th. It had taken several more years, and Frank moving in with Martin, before they finally decided to take the leap. They'd visited Lambertville several times to see Frank's sister who lived there, and they'd fallen in love with the Delaware River town. "It's a city, but you would never guess that from the size," Martin had told Laurel the first time she'd gone to see them. "How could you?" she'd replied. "It looked like a town, but nothing like the one they'd grown up in. This town had character, artists, tourists, and spectacular views of the river." She and Jeremy had made semi-regular trips to visit the couple, and the seed for their future move had been planted. "We're going to get all green acres," Jeremy once said as they rode the bus back to Manhattan. The possibility of moving had come up again in conversation. "We could get a pet pig and wear overalls." "I know you're only half joking," Laurel had replied. "Only half. We'll see how things go." Laurel had smiled, but by then she'd known how things would go. Jeremy would continue to be disappointed in his thespian dreams, let alone his hopes of paying the bills with an occasional print ad. She would finish her book, she hadn't published yet, and it would land like a lead balloon. They would abandon their fantasies and move back to Chicago or Philadelphia or somewhere that didn't remind them every day that they'd failed. Or they could move to New Jersey and pretend it had all been a dream. She'd left Durant's office and driven 6 blocks to her uncle's home. She had not told Martin why she was there. The only people who'd known she had seen a therapist were Jeremy and Eileen, and whoever Eileen had gossiped to besides Luther. She'd been worried someone would think she was having emotional difficulties and start watching her. For the sake of the baby, of course. She hated the idea of being observed. It was one of the things that had troubled her so much these past few months. She had the distinct feeling someone was watching her. When Martin had asked what brought her to town on her recent visits, she'd just told him she loved Lambertville, which was true, and that it gave her a chance for some Laurel time. He'd said he understood, and he hadn't pried any further. "Let's go to Moonscape," Frank said, after welcoming Laurel into their house. It was one of several on the block that had been renovated and turned into show homes. Once owned by one of the town's founding families, it seemed too large for just a couple. but she knew they loved it here, and they enjoyed living in part of Lambertville's heritage. "I like it there," Laurel replied. Moonscape was one of her favorite restaurants nearby. A moment later, Martin came down the stairs, looking terrific in his late 50s. Laurel smiled up at him, wondering if he was deliberately making an entrance. He always came down the stairs when she showed up. She suspected it was how he greeted every visitor. "I'll just grab my jacket," Martin said. He took a windbreaker from a coat rack, and seconds later, the three of them were walking to the restaurant. Chapter 6. Maybe this is just your subconscious asking for some time off. Poppy Durant spoke in the calming, pleasant tone Laurel had so liked about her when she'd first come to see the therapist. Durant's office was located on the ground floor of her home on Station Court, far enough from the beaten path to give the house a sense of privacy, and close enough to the Delaware River that you could see it from the office windows. It gave Durant the added advantage of a relaxing landscape to soothe her clients. Laurel was sitting on a love seat facing the windows, while Poppy sat in a high-backed chair across from her, a notepad and pen in her lap. Laurel had seen her take notes many times during their sessions, and she wondered what she actually had to say about her. "Or maybe I'm finished writing," Laurel said, surprised at how defeatist she sounded. "You don't really believe that," replied Poppy. She was right, thought Laurel. She always was. This was not about the end of her writing career or the loss of her impulse to create imaginary worlds with words. This was about something else entirely. But what? Poppy smiled gently. Everything about her was calm, and it bothered Laurel as much as it inspired her to want to be like that. Durant was somewhere in her 50s, Laurel guessed, and well-appointed, like her home. She wore long skirts with matching blouses and comfortable shoes, with one leg draped over the other as she sat cross-legged in her chair. "No, I don't," admitted Laurel. "I'm just trying to understand what is happening to me." "And what is that?" "The dreams," Laurel said, almost blurting it. Durant cocked her head and looked at Laurel. This was new information. "What dreams are these?" "The ones I've been having for the past few months, maybe longer, after Isabel was born, but not much." "Were you having them when we first met?" "No," said Laurel. "After I stopped coming. I would have told you about them if we were still meeting." "We are still meeting," Durant replied, smiling kindly. "You're here." "Yes, I am," said Laurel, and she proceeded to tell her about the recurring nightmares. There wasn't just one, or perhaps there was one with several variations, several acts to it, all ending with her running over a woman in the road. "A dog, too," Laurel said. "Sometimes I dream about a dog." "Have you ever had a dog?" Durant asked. She was writing in her notepad by then, taking what Laurel thought were the most copious notes she'd ever taken when they were together. "No," replied Laurel. "Not since I was a child, anyway. Do you think this has something to do with Isabel turning one this month?" Durant looked at her. "That's an unusual connection. But maybe you're right. What is it about her turning a year old that would cause you to feel stressed?" Laurel shrugged. "What about it wouldn't make me feel that way? Raising an infant is stressful." "Tell me about it," Durant said. "Wait until she's 15, then you'll really know what stress is." Laurel had never seen any family photographs in the office. She had no idea if Poppy Durant had children or a husband or a wife, for that matter. There was nothing in the room that revealed the woman's personal life, and Laurel assumed it was meant to be that way. She was a client there, not a friend. "I'm just worried," Laurel said, "about everything. Jeremy is gone all day. Isabel needs what babies need, and she doesn't know what a clock is. I'm stuck near the finish line of a third book that's very different from the first two, and I'm not..." "What's it about?" Durant asked, interrupting her. "The book? It's about a couple who leave New York City for a new life in a small town." "That sounds familiar." "You're very perceptive, Poppy," Laurel said dryly. "That's what makes you a good therapist." Durant set her notepad aside. Laurel noticed her glance casually at her watch. Their time was coming to a close. I think you've hit on something here, Durant said. You're trying to write about your own life, really, with some fictionalizing. A lot. Okay, a lot. But it's still your own story in crucial ways. I haven't told you what it's about. You don't have to, said Durant. It doesn't take a genius to see the parallels, and these parallels make you nervous. How will the story end, you wonder? How will your own story end? Where is it all going? You have a child turning one. You have a husband working far from home. You have a book to finish. It's all aligning to make you feel very pressured. That's a good word for it, Laurel said. So much pressure. Thinking a moment, she added, But why run over a woman in the road? It's possible the woman is you. Laurel stared at her, startled by the comment. I don't understand. Exactly, said Durant. Your anxieties want you to understand. They want your attention. My anxieties? Your fears, your doubts, your worries. It's all coming to a head right now, but you don't want it to. I don't want to face it. Possibly. Whatever it is. You're almost there. So I run it over instead, Laurel said, with a bit of reluctant triumph in her voice. It was a breakthrough of sorts, an explanation. Whether it was the right one or not, it had given her a reason for the dreams when she'd had none before. I think we should meet again, said Poppy. Soon, Laurel. I want to help you through this. Laurel almost felt like crying. She'd spent weeks wanting someone to help her, in the way only a good therapist could. Are you free this Friday? That's 3 days from now. I know it is, said Durant. I think you could use a couple sessions a week, at least until you're past whatever is troubling you. Everything is troubling me. Absolutely everything. So Friday it is? Yes, said Laurel. I'm sure Eileen can babysit. She never goes anywhere. You could always bring the baby. It's not a problem. When she starts crying, it is, Laurel replied. No, I'll ask Eileen to help out. And you'll tell Jeremy? That stopped Laurel. Jeremy knew she'd seen Poppy after Isabel was born, but she would rather not tell him about this, at least not for now. Of course, Laurel lied. We don't keep secrets from each other. Except for the dreams, Laurel thought. You haven't told him about the dreams, or the dog, or the way Luther Maddox looks at you sometimes. Is 10 o'clock good for you? Asked Durant. Fine, said Laurel. I'm up so early, the day's half over by then. Yes, I'll see you Friday. Laurel got her purse from the floor and they both stood up. Durant walked her to the door. See you Friday, she said. You can show yourself out. Thank you, Laurel said, handing Durant a check to cover the 50-minute fee. She turned and walked down the hall as Durant closed the door and returned to her notes. Laurel Calloway was proving to be a most interesting client. Chapter 8. Martin and Frank had always seemed like a perfect match of opposites. Martin was tall and had been thin his entire life. Frank was short and had the build of a boxer who hadn't seen the inside of a ring for 40 years. Martin retained a full head of hair, mostly gray now, while Frank had lost his early and had been balding when Laurel first met him years ago. The men had made a trip to Michigan when Laurel was still in her teens, as a way of introducing Frank to the family. It had surprised Laurel when they left New York. At the time, she couldn't imagine anyone wanting to leave such a magical city. But it had also led to her own move out of Manhattan into the rural surroundings they now called home. Martin and Frank had been the ones to suggest they look in the area, going so far as to connect them with the realtor. While they had not chosen Lambertville, they were close enough that they could visit each other with some frequency. Martin and Frank were the first guests they'd invited to their house in the woods, and the couple had likewise christened their new home with a dinner party a week after they'd moved in. Moonscape was a local gem that had been in business for years, located just a few blocks from the bridge to Pennsylvania. The restaurant was owned by a colorful woman who always seemed to be there. Credence was an odd name for anyone, let alone a woman, but she could be found welcoming and seating diners for lunch and dinner every day, except Monday, when the restaurant was closed. They arrived and decided to sit on the porch. Credence led them to a table, saying hello to each of them and remembering Laurel's name, even though she was not a regular. Handing them menus before heading off, Credence said, "Enjoy the meal, and if you need anything." "We know where to find you," finished Martin. They were greeted within minutes by a server named Jared, who took their drink order and promised to be right back. Laurel scanned the menu, already knowing what was on it. According to Frank, it hadn't changed in 10 years. Within 20 minutes, they were eating their lunch and getting caught up on each other's lives. There were only two other occupied tables on the porch, giving them the sense of privacy Laurel enjoyed in a restaurant. At one point, Martin leaned in slightly and said, "You seem troubled, Laurel." "Do I?" she replied. Maybe only finishing half her salad had been a giveaway. The men had ordered burgers and were nearly through with them, their plates empty, except for uneaten lettuce and a few stray French fries. She caught a glance between them, suggesting they'd both sensed something off with her mood or demeanor. She sighed. "I've been having these strange dreams," she began, and she told them about the nightmares she'd had the past few months. She did not mention having told the same things to Poppy an hour earlier. "I have bad dreams all the time," Frank said, trying to reassure her it was nothing to be upset about. "Don't I, Martin?" "He does, and it's not that uncommon for me to wake him up. He mumbles as if some monster is chasing him and getting closer." "I've even woken up with night sweats a few times," Frank added. "What do you think causes it?" Laurel asked, hoping for any insights into her own subconscious she hadn't gotten from Poppy. "I don't really know," said Frank. "It just happens. Maybe it's the spicy food I'm not supposed to have. I've never thought about what I ate on those nights. Could be nachos, could be strawberry cheesecake." "He sneaks those," Martin said, smiling. "I won't allow either of them into the house." Laurel laughed. "How do you sneak nachos?" "Believe me," Frank said, "it can be done." Laurel then mused that her dreams may have something to do with Strickland, a town with no dogs and a lot of old people. Scott, the 20-something realtor, was the exception, not the rule. "Have you ever heard of anything strange about Strickland? Maybe the groundwater is contaminated or, I don't know, just something about that town." "I always loved visiting my grandparents there," Frank said, wiping his mouth with a napkin he'd had in his lap. Laurel stared at him long enough for Frank to realize he'd said something surprising. "Are you okay?" Frank asked. "I'm fine," Laurel said, shaking her head slightly as if to clear her mind. "I didn't know you were from Strickland." "I'm not. My grandparents lived there." "And this is the first time I'm hearing it?" "Surely you've heard this story before," Martin said. "You're just not remembering." "I don't speak much about it," Frank said. "My parents moved to Brooklyn before I was born. I'm a native New Yorker. But we visited my grandparents in Strickland until I was 8 or 9 years old." "And of course Gloria lives here," Martin added, referring to his sister-in-law. "She always wanted to move back." "But not to Strickland," said Laurel. "No," replied Frank, with no further explanation. "What happened with your grandparents?" asked Laurel. "They died," said Frank. "That's it? They died?" wondered Laurel. She waited for more information, but none came. "I feel like dessert," Martin said, waving at Jared to come over to the table. The waiter had been cleaning off a two-top. "I thought you didn't allow it in the house," Frank said, feigning disapproval. "We're not in the house." Martin and Frank ordered dessert. Laurel did not. She spent the remainder of their time at Moonscape wondering why her Uncle Frank had never told her he had a close connection to Strickland. And is this why they had so enthusiastically encouraged Laurel and Jeremy to move to the area? "You're imagining things," Laurel told herself. "At this rate, you won't know what's a dream and what's reality." She did not go back into their house when they returned from lunch. They did not press her any further about whatever was bothering her. It was as if there had been nothing but happy thoughts and casual conversation for the past hour and a half. "We want to see the baby again," Frank said, hugging Laurel. They'd reached her car in the driveway. "Thank goodness for Eileen," Martin said, stepping up to hug her too. Again, that strange sensation, that intrusion into her thoughts by something dark and alarming. "Yes, thank goodness," Laurel replied, squeezing her uncle. Then, the thought coming to her, she said to Frank, "She must have known your grandparents. She and Pete have lived there forever." Frank shrugged. "You'd have to ask her. I imagine you're right." "I'll do that," replied Laurel, making a mental note of it. Maybe she could get more information from Eileen than she got from Frank. The small world she'd moved to seemed to be getting smaller. They said one more goodbye before the men headed inside, and Laurel drove slowly away. Her feelings of dread had only increased, however irrational they were, however nonsensical she wanted them to be. She wanted to be happy. She wanted to feel hopeful. She did not want this. And she had not said anything to them about Eileen looking after the baby. She hoped it was just an assumption they'd made. Chapter 9. Laurel and Jeremy had been anticipating a rare early evening together. His promotion had him overseeing a staff of 30 people, who in turn oversaw the managing of several dozen properties across Philadelphia. It was a long way from the stages of Broadway he'd once imagined himself pacing, but it paid better, and it gave his family a sense of security. It also gave Jeremy his own identity as a successful man, apart from Laurel's achievements as an author. She was able to enjoy both the fortune and the fame part, but Jeremy had stopped wanting to be any kind of celebrity. And the truth was that Laurel was only semi-famous, with the kind of public recognition enjoyed by writers at local book readings with a line of fans waiting to have their books signed. Outside of that, she was no more noticeable than he was. And Laurel was happy about that. She'd worried her rising success would cause problems in the relationship, but once Jeremy went to work for Philly Star Properties, and especially since Isabel's birth, there had been no signs of professional jealousy. She had her writing and a child. He had his job and a stay-at-home wife. Laurel could live with it, as long as staying at home meant writing another novel, and another. It was an arrangement that worked for them. Most weeknights, Jeremy didn't get home until late. Isabel would be in her crib by then, satiated and sleeping until the middle of the night. Laurel would wait for him to arrive around 8 p.m. if he was on time, which for his employer meant after a 10-hour shift. But tonight, he'd arranged to leave the office at 5 o'clock, and by the time the evening news came on an hour later, he was walking in the door. Tonight was a date night. For a couple with a baby, that meant dinner at the table while Isabel slept, hoping she did not wake up and demand the attention afforded only to infants. Laurel knew she could have asked Eileen over so they could drive into Lambertville or go to another restaurant within driving distance, but she felt like she'd asked enough of the old woman. Her neighbor's age was showing more and more these days, and Laurel had decided against arranging a night out. They would have a delicious meal, complete with candles on the table. Then, if all went well, they would make love. It didn't happen often anymore, and Jeremy attributed it to the stresses of his job. He was frequently exhausted when he got home. Laurel, too, had shied away several times when the opportunity for sex presented itself, sometimes in the form of a naked Jeremy in an open bathrobe. Her excuse was the baby, or a headache from writing all day. It wasn't to the point she worried about their future, but it was an increasing feature of their marriage. "It happens with every couple," her mother said recently when Laurel mentioned their diminishing sex life. "Love and friendship are what make a couple last." Her parents had been together for 40 years by then, so she gave her mother credit for knowing something about longevity. "Is Jeremy bothered by this?" her mother asked. "Not that I can tell," Laurel said, "but you never can with men." Her mother had laughed at that, and the subject had not come up again in their conversations. Laurel had been lost in her thoughts about talking to her mother, about the dinner, and what may or may not follow it when Jeremy got home. She was in the kitchen and heard him come in the front door. A few moments later, he was standing next to her at the stove. He slid his arm around her and kissed her cheek. "That smells so good," he said. Laurel stirred a pot of New England clam chowder she'd made from scratch. Fresh bread cooled on a sideboard, and a salad with no fewer than 10 ingredients waited on the table to be tossed. "Me or the food?" she said, smiling. "Both." Feigning humility, Laurel replied, "It's just soup and salad." She knew she was a good cook. "There is no such thing as just with your cooking. I'm guessing this was a 2-hour operation."
90 minutes with prep time.
"Of course." He kissed her again and pulled his arm away. "Let me shower and shave." "Oh my." He winked at her. "That's right, Mrs. Calloway. I brought dessert."
Laurel looked down at the front of his pants. "I'm sure it's my favorite," she said. His eyes widened in mock surprise. "I hope there's no competition."
"I don't know, Jeremy. There are some mighty fine-looking men in Strickland.
If you like octogenarians?"
They both laughed.
Jeremy left the kitchen to shower and change, and Laurel turned the heat down to simmer. She smiled to herself. Maybe they were going to have a real date night after all. The lovemaking had been sweet for them both. Neither mentioned how long it had been since their last real sex. The weather was getting cool at night, but it was still warm enough to leave the windows open. Laurel lay on her back, looking up at the revolving ceiling fan. She knew it would soon be too cold to have it on. She and Jeremy both liked the sound of it, a low hum that lulled them to sleep. With luck, they could get a few hours in before Isabel decided it was time to wake them up. A baby monitor sat on the dresser for just that purpose.
"You know she's going to be a year old in 2 weeks," Laurel said, glancing at the monitor.
"Is that so?" said Jeremy. He'd rolled on his side, facing the windows, away from Laurel. Laurel punched him playfully on the back. "You forgot your daughter's birthday?"
"She's never had one before," he said in his own defense. "She's turning 1. Thank you for the reminder."
She didn't blame him for not remembering. Birthdays, kindergarten graduation, anniversaries of first steps, first words, first everything, they would all become part of their permanent calendars. She had begun to understand what her mother and sister had gone through, and it caused her as much anxiety as joy.
"Maybe that's what's going on," Laurel said, speaking her thoughts out loud.
"What are you talking about?" Jeremy asked over his shoulder. He had not turned around.
"These crazy dreams, these thoughts. I keep seeing things, Jeremy, but in a gauzy way, like I can't really identify what I'm seeing. I hear things, too, like a dog barking."
"In the distance?"
"No, like it's right next to me, barking to protect me."
"From what?"
"I don't know," Laurel said, exasperated. "It's so real and unreal at the same time."
Jeremy was silent a long moment. Then he rolled over and faced her, his face close to hers on their overlapping pillows.
"What dreams are you talking about?"
It was the first time she'd mentioned them to him. She felt silly for withholding it, as if she had reasons to keep it private. Bad dreams were nothing unusual. She turned sideways to face him, her head propped on her hand.
"I keep dreaming about running someone over in the road."
"That's violent," he said. "Completely out of character with anything I would ever do. And I recognize her, but I don't know where from."
"Her?"
"It's a woman in the road reaching out for me to stop, but I don't. I run her over and just keep going."
Then, as if suddenly remembering details she'd forgotten, she added, "And there's a fire behind me."
"A fire? Something's burning. Oh, and a dog. A dog keeps barking. No, wait. The dog's in the car with me, barking."
"At the woman?"
"I don't know, Jeremy. It's just barking, and I run over this woman, and I see flames in the rearview mirror, and I just keep going."
Jeremy stared at her, weighing his words.
"I think maybe you should call Poppy."
Sighing, Laurel replied, "I did call her, and I saw her."
"You saw her?"
"This morning. Then I had lunch with Uncle Martin and Frank."
"What did Poppy say?"
"She said it's the stress of everything, the baby, the new book, all of it."
"Am I included in your stresses?"
"No," Laurel said. "How could you be? You're never here."
Jeremy didn't know how to take that.
"Is that a problem for you?
I can talk to management, tell them I have to cut my hours back. No, you love your job. I'll figure this out. Everything's going to be fine. Their conversation was abruptly interrupted by the sound of Isabel's crying coming through the monitor. She's early, Laurel said. I'll get it. She swung her legs off the mattress, sliding her feet into her slippers.
You're sure? Asked Jeremy.
I don't mind. Laurel thought about pointing out that he'd made no effort to get up, but she let it go. The evening had been a needed distraction she was grateful to have. Good food, good sex, a good night affected only slightly by their conversation about her dreams. She glided out of the bedroom, down the hall toward the nursery. I'm coming, she said, hurrying toward the sound of her child.